a shout out from the homeland. The voters of West Virginia prefer Hillary Clinton more than 2-1 to Barack Obama. Is it the economy, stupid, or something else? The Clinton campaign living in its own private West Virginia this morning. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 14th. We're going to take a look at the new political map emerging from this long primary campaign. Also, more stormy weather from Myanmar. China digs out of the rubble. And on the beat in Iraq, where getting the story right can be a death sentence. That and all the news. It was an expected win for Hillary Clinton, but Democrats are mulling over the numbers from yesterday's West Virginia primary. Clinton scored a lopsided win over Barack Obama, winning 67% to his 26%, calling it an overwhelming vote of confidence and another argument she should be the Democratic nominee.
The White House is won in the swing states, and I am winning the swing states.
Clinton ran strongest among blue-collar whites. She picked up 16 delegates, but that's barely a dent in Obama's overall lead. In exit polls, barely a third of Clinton supporters said they'd vote for Barack Obama over Republican John McCain in a November matchup.
A new storm is taking aim at Myanmar. The UN's Weather Center says the isolated Southeast Asian nation could be hammered by a second cyclone in the next 24 to 48 hours. A Thai medical team is being allowed in, and the U.S. is ready to send a third relief shipment. Chinese media sources say survivors are emerging from the rubble at the epicenter of Monday's earthquake in China's Sichuan province. Soldiers and rescue workers are starting to reach the most isolated towns. The Chinese government has been mobilizing citizens to help victims using wireless technology. One resident of the city of Chengdu says people are staying tuned to their cell phones.
The government has used their system of mass text messaging, and they send messages to us and ask us to give food and water and whatever we can to help those people in the countryside.
Chinese media sources say the death toll is close to about 15,000.
Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff says the town of Pitcher, Oklahoma, looks like a small nuclear bomb went off. More than 100 homes in the fading mining town were destroyed by a weekend tornado. Victims will receive federal aid to relocate rather than rebuild. Before the twister, the town had been declared a Superfund site and a government buyout of homes was already underway. MySpace has won a $230 million federal court judgment against two spammers who sent more than 730,000 junk emails as fake friends. Even if it doesn't collect, MySpace's security chief says it could deter other nuisance attacks on the online hangout.
Two sports stories. Barry Bonds facing new charges in the baseball steroids investigation. Annika Sorenstam is retiring from ladies professional golf. Crude oil rose to a new trading record today. And our takeaway question relates to natural disasters. What motivates you to make a donation? It's a conversation on our website. What motivates you to make a donation in the wake of an international disaster?
We're talking about the economics of altruism, and we'll have a conversation about that. And we'd love to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll be back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. If you pay attention to political coverage, you hear the word landslide a lot, but rarely do you see a landslide like the one Hillary Clinton won in the West Virginia primary last night. Hillary Clinton took the state by more than 40 percentage points over Barack Obama. Clinton campaigned hard in the state. Barack Obama was barely there. Emily Corio is a reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Despite the fact that the outcome was never in doubt, voters turned out in droves. Emily, the people of West Virginia have spoken. What's their message?
The Their message is that they want to see Senator Hillary Clinton continue to fight for the Democratic nomination for president.
And do you think they're looking beyond the nomination to the November election? What do you think this primary result means for whoever the Democratic nominee is in November?
Well, I think they are. I mean, they several people that I spoke to, so I can just say anecdotally that they do think that Hillary Clinton is the best candidate to face John McCain in the general election, and that in order to for a Democrat to win the White House, they think Hillary Clinton needs to be the person running. And several people I talked to, in fact, said they won't even go out and vote if Hillary Clinton isn't on the ticket.
In your coverage and reporting on this primary and, you know, in your travels around the state yesterday, how emotionally involved did you find the people of West Virginia in this contest?
Well, I was around Senator Clinton and at her event last night. So, of course, those people who go out of their way to go to an event like that are probably already more excited about the campaign and a stronger supporter. But Clinton did also stop by kind of an open-air market on yesterday during the day in Charleston, and she did surprise people there. And it turned out a lot of the people that she surprised up and down these aisles of potted geraniums and hanging flower baskets said, "Oh, I voted for you earlier today." So it definitely seemed like a lot of people who were out yesterday afternoon in Charleston were Hillary supporters, and those are the people that she was talking to yesterday afternoon just by chance.
Now, Clinton has a big reputation in the state of West Virginia, both the Bill and Hillary. West Virginia went for Bill Clinton. Is there nostalgia in this vote for Hillary Clinton, or is it fear of Barack Obama in some sense?
It's probably a combination of both, based on what I've heard from other people. Obama's spokesperson in West Virginia last night said, people just know Hillary Clinton better. She's been here with her husband. She's been in the state a lot this past week. Barack Obama hasn't really been around much. People don't know him. And the governor, I spoke to him last night, and he said, you know, if Barack Obama gets the nomination, then he'll have to come to West Virginia, and West Virginians will have to get to know him because, you know, he said at this point they just don't know him, and they do know Hillary Clinton better. They do feel like they know her better.
Something like 2 in 10 in the exit polls said race was a factor in their vote. That's according to national exit polls. Can you envision a message from the Barack Obama campaign that would be persuasive among the voters you spoke with last night?
Well, you know, no one I spoke with said that race was an issue in how they decided. They cited his inexperience. They cited the controversy with his former pastor. So I think maybe the message from his campaign would have to be that give him a chance, you know, come to the state, let him introduce himself to you, tell him more about himself. And I think that's what our governor was saying, you know, and our governor is a Democrat, that if Barack Obama does end up getting the nomination, then he just needs to introduce himself to West Virginians.
Even after this long campaign, Emily Corio is a reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting, doing great work for us in a primary that we didn't think was going to be a story, but turned out to be a very important story. Emily Corio, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, very important, because it is about this theme, which we've seen that has dogged Barack Obama, of not being able to capture that blue-collar vote. And I think, as we've talked about many times, and Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway political director, has now joined us in this conversation, we're learning a lot about voters across the map that we didn't necessarily expect going into this campaign.
Right. Well, what do we know? We thought this race was going to be over in February or maybe
right.
maybe
6th,
January.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that there was a race last night that was in some ways even more seismic than West Virginia, which is, did you know that there was a congressional race in Mississippi? It was a special election, and the Democrat won in this seat that was such a safe Republican seat that they took the Republican out of it to replace Trent Lott in the Senate. This was not supposed to be a problem for the Republicans, and yet the Democrat won it by 8 points. And one Mississippi political scientist told the Associated Press Republicans should be terrified. Now, why should we care? Barack Obama's campaign was arguing yesterday that this is not an ordinary political year, and that this whole issue of you must win West Virginia, you must win these white working class voters to win, is based on a, as they say, a 1990s political calculus. I mean, there is some
evidence
for that.
So that's proof to their argument, because that's actually not the first Democratic congressman who's won in a district that Republicans would have thought was there. And what's interesting about that, and talking about race as we've done in the West Virginia contest, is that this was a campaign where Republicans really tried to tie that Democratic nominee to Reverend Wright and Barack Obama, and it just didn't work.
It did not work. And, you know, Obama has been saying all along, I have a new political calculus. The Clinton campaign has been pushing back, saying we do extraordinarily well. And last week, the New York Times had this map, which caused a lot of Democrats' hearts to sink, because they said the states that are at play, Michigan, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all these states that Barack Obama did not win. But Barack Obama says this is going to be a different year, and there's evidence for that.
There is evidence. Right. I mean, the negatives for the Republicans, even throughout this kind of knockdown dragout of Hillary and Barack Obama, have increased throughout the past few months. So the Republicans haven't gained much from this, even though you would expect from the chattering class that they're actually going to win the election in November.
Well, I mean, Barack Obama lost Florida with more votes than John McCain won Florida when there wasn't even a campaign in Florida. I mean, this whole sort of $5 a gallon gasoline price that people are facing is huge. I mean, think about it. It's causing Americans to get out of their cars and get into mass transit. That's a huge behavioral change. So if it can force people to do that, can it get them to change their electoral behavior? Maybe it can. So yes, Hillary Clinton won hugely in West Virginia. And I think if she'd had that kind of a victory 3 months ago, it could have perhaps changed the calculus in that whole month of February where she lost so much.
It's hard for her to catch up on those 100-plus delegate lead that Barack Obama has. And it's also interesting in terms of looking at the map that there seems to be some counties, I think John or Andrea, you may have told me this, but when you look at the counties that Hillary Clinton did the best in, from eastern New York all the way down to Appalachia, it was those counties where you were talking about working-class whites. Yeah. But they're tied together by counties through different states as opposed to in just one state.
Right. It's the demographics, it's the economics, and it's the race.
Is there a reasonable specter that in a close race, some sort of 2 of 10 voters for whom race is a big factor could be decisive in November? I mean, Adora mentions this constantly, that Barack Obama is not the African-American candidate, because if whites weren't with him in a big way, he would have no real traction in this race. But the question changes when you get to November, and little things can have big impacts.
It would be foolish to say that race won't be a factor in November if indeed Barack Obama is the nominee. But what he is saying is, I have a new calculus. I'm bringing different people in to vote, so you can't just take all the old rules. And it's a long reach for Democrats. They've had some hard, you know, depressing losses in the last 8 years. But so to say race wouldn't be a factor, I think, would be foolish. And one thing about this long Democratic nominating process is, I think, it's to some extent it's numbed people to the effect of race and of gender in a general election. Those things can't be forgotten. But the whole political picture, the terrible economy, the war in Iraq, those are helping the Democrats, and it's been consistent throughout this primary campaign. Even yesterday in West Virginia, everybody said the race was over, yet record turnout. Mm. So this, you know, wanting to participate, this yearning is there.
And Hillary Clinton is saying she's determined more than ever to carry on.
Yes. And since when were primary campaigns about new voters? They've always been about the old activist, voted forever, go to the campaigns, do the door-to-door volunteers. It's not about activists anymore. The primary process has manufactured wild cards in a deck that now we don't even know what the game is.
I think we'd be foolish to think that Hillary Clinton would get out early. There's nothing in our history to suggest it. If you look through this primary campaign, it's all about Ben. I am not getting out. I am not quitting. I am coming back.
Well, it's just a couple.
We're getting
more.
Out, though.
Yeah, we are. It's just a couple of weeks. Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway Political Director. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Here's a question. Are good deeds moral or are they economic? What is the economics of altruism? For whatever reason, Americans give a lot of money to charitable causes. And of course, this week, there is no shortage of possible donation targets. Three disasters have claimed almost 50,000 lives in Burma and China. Even tornadoes here in the United States have been devastating. Aid is heading to all three regions. But the takeaway question we're asking today is, how do we decide what to support in times of disaster? What factors are decisive for us? And so Stephen Dubner, author of the Freakonomics blog and book, our buddy, is back in our studios. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, if we think about altruism from an economics point of view, rather than from a purely psychological moral point of view, what sorts of interesting truths kind of drop out?
Well, it's interesting. Economists really wanted to figure out how to measure altruism because it's obviously important. It's not important just from a financial perspective, but it's important from understanding the human animal and how cooperative and how selfish we are, right? So economics for hundreds of years has stated that we are self-interested, that we don't do something unless it's good for us. But what about altruism? How do you explain that? So a bunch of economists set out to measure it, and indeed they discovered kind of the magic bullet in the form of these experiments, these games that are played in the lab. They discovered that people generally are altruistic, and yet now there's another movement of economists who have basically said, you know what, that last 30 years of research, we don't think it's right. Basically, what it boils down to is people don't give unless they do get something for themselves. So the whole notion of altruism is really starting to be thrown out the window. The notion of pure altruism, the phrase that economists use is impure altruism.
Now, that means that you're getting something, you're getting like an incentive or a cash payback, or, I mean, there's
not
a whole range of things that you're
right,
getting.
Right. There are a whole range of things. Right. So you can imagine anything from, you know, on a public radio pledge drive, right? This might get me thrown off the show, but I'll say two things about that. One is when you get the tote bag or when you get the CD, right? That's a little bit of a quid pro quo, right? But the other thing is, you don't feel like you're paying for that radio station, even though it may be somewhat tax supported. Taxes, one could argue, are a form of charitable giving, right? Let's say you're in a 30% tax bracket overall. You are giving 30% of every dollar you make to causes other than yourself, right? So a lot of people could feel that, well, geez, I'm already being very charitable. Why on earth do I now want to give more money to people who aren't doing anything for me?
But isn't that actually kind of a cynical view? Because you can be giving money, right? And what you get back is feeling good, like somehow you've contributed in some way in helping someone else's life a little better. But that would be a pure motivated action.
Are you implying that economists are not cynical? I mean, that's the point, really.
Yeah, but it just seems so harsh to say that the only reason why someone gives is so they can get a plaque or so that they can get a bag or something else.
It is almost never the only reason, but when people think about altruism, they seriously, seriously undervalue the pieces that are coming back to people.
Now, and some of them are very intangible. Tell me about this study that actually brought chills to my spine over the research into what motivates people to give in a door-to-door situation.
He's a bit obsessed with this. Go ahead, this was a great study.
All right, so this is a study done by an economist named John List, who you should remember because he is a young guy who's kind of at the forefront of experimental economics and has a lot to say about altruism. And John List, who's now at the University of Chicago, did a study down in North Carolina. They were trying to raise money for some kind of hurricane relief, hurricane barrier, something, you know, being built on the shore of North Carolina there. What they were trying to do was test different treatments of solicitation. In other words, if you're collecting door-to-door, what are the best things to do? Should you drive up in a car or should you walk? Should you mention that you have a bunch of federal seed money or should you not? Should you ask for a particular donation or should you leave it open? Along the way, because economists are cynical and sometimes cruel, they also noted the metrics of each of the people who were soliciting donations. A tall white man, a short black woman, a blonde woman who was pretty on a scale of X to 10, right? They had people judge the attractiveness of each of the solicitors. And here's what happened. No matter whether you were using the best methodologies available, in other words, naming the seed money, driving up in a nice car, whatever, all the best methodologies invariably got beaten if you were any random blonde woman. In other words, if you're a blonde woman soliciting door to door, you're going to get better donations, and not just from men, also from women.
That's a very interesting result. We could talk an hour for that. But I just want to point out one thing, and this is in your blog, that during the tsunami and the aftermath of that, Americans came up with $1.9 billion. Hurricane Katrina, $5.3 billion. Pakistan earthquake, $150 million.
That's a pittance.
But people do give. At what point?
But why not to Pakistan? And why?
In that case, the reason
I
use those three examples were this. The Asian tsunami was a big cause for a variety of reasons. One, it came right around Christmas time. People are in the mood to give at Christmas time.
Let's not
forget the tax break, okay? So in the we should say this. The United States is almost unique in this regard. We give so much in this country.
2% of GDP.
2% of GDP. $300 billion a year. Phenomenal. Now, here's what would be a great experiment if I were king for a day. Take a bunch of states in the United States, 20. Half of them, get rid of the federal tax exemption deduction for charity for a couple of years, and half of them keep it and see what happens.
He experiments with all of us. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics author. Thanks a lot. And now, more headlines from Femi Okeh.
It is 28 minutes past the hour, and here are some of the news making... Here's some of the stories making news around the world. Chinese authorities say the destruction at the epicenter of the earthquake that hit central China this week is even worse than expected. In one town close to the epicenter, rescuers found less than a quarter of the population of 10,000 people alive. The Thai Prime Minister has gone to Myanmar to ask the junta to allow in more foreign aid workers. Aid is still being very carefully filtered into the country. The Red Cross has staff inside Myanmar and have just come back from surveying some of the worst hit areas. This morning I spoke to Joe Lowry in Yangon. His boss, Bridget Gardner, relayed some of the things that she had seen, and we spoke about that just a few hours ago.
So one of the most disturbing images she talked about was people that were literally sandblasted by the force of the storm. You had winds of 100 miles an hour and more whipping up sand from the beaches and literally sandblasting the top layer of skin off people. So Red Cross volunteers are doing first aid on the dockside, and that saves the precious resources at the hospitals who can deal with even more serious injuries.
And to add to the serious conditions already in Myanmar, we're also getting weather reports from the area of a tropical disturbance. So we're expecting to see some very heavy amounts of rain in the next 12 to 24 hours, about 2.5 inches of rain there. Indian police have been searching the sites of 8 bomb attacks, which killed at least 60 people in the northwestern city of Jaipur. The Rajasthan State Police Chief described it as a terrorist attack aimed at causing maximum loss of life. And also, a car bomb has exploded at a police barracks in the northern Basque region of Spain, killing a policeman and wounding 4 other people. Spanish authorities have blamed the militant Basque separatist group, known as ETA, which is spelled E-T-A. And that's a look at some of your international headlines from around the world.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On this Wednesday, May 14th, we are going to return to the story of the aftermath of that 7.9 earthquake that hit China this week, where we, like so many, have been struck by the widespread and rapid response by the communist government in China, for which they have been widely praised for responding so quickly, unlike intense criticism for other crises like a similar quake 30 years ago, or more recently the SARS crisis. What does this response say about the Chinese government today? And for some thoughts on that, we're going to go to William Hess, a China analyst with the forecasting company Global Insight. So, William, is this response based on a concern for its citizens, or is it about bolstering the government's image both inside the country and outside the country?
You know, I think this time it has hints of both. Certainly for within China, the balance has always been that the government is the guarantor of stability and relief in a time of crisis. And this is certainly a situation for the domestic audience where they really have to deliver results. So sending Wen Jiabao out to Sichuan province within hours of the quake actually having taken place really indicates that resources will be soon to follow. I think for the international audience, maybe for those looking at long-term investments or even those looking at the Olympics, certainly they want to make sure that they can they have a convincing presentation to say that in the event of any kind of uncertainty or calamity, that they have the resources to really handle a crisis.
And obviously this is a very unique time for China as they wind up for the Beijing Olympics, and they've been facing months and weeks of criticism over the way they handled the protests in Tibet and their involvement in Sudan. So to see the prime minister out there with his hard hat on, ministering to these people who are in great need, I mean, that's really quite a different vision of Chinese leadership than we've ever seen.
Well, within China, Wen Jiabao is known in some circles as the people's premier. So he's been the public face of the government response to a lot of humanitarian crises, and tries to be the kind of a leader with which people would identify. Hu Jintao is more reclusive. Wen Jiabao is more of the public figure. But looking at the current events, I think they're really trying to make the people identify with the leadership, and maybe during it, this represents a wind down after winding up to leading up to the torch relay. So I think there's been ups and downs here in the month leading up to the Olympics. They were hoping for a smooth ride in, but we keep seeing these large swings up and down, and this is a trough that I think that they're going to try to come out of.
William Hess, I wonder if there's some possibility that the Chinese government is trying to get out ahead of potential instability from this. The Wall Street Journal has a front-page story today about the earthquake exposing the disparities of income between the rich and poor in China, and that's going to be increasingly apparent to everyone in China as reporting and the full scale of this disaster is learned. Do you think it's a sort of a preemptive strike here?
Well, before this crisis hit, I mean, that was one of the key issues in the headlines talking about the economy is the issue of inequality. So for the government, in a sense, this allows them to focus really on their relief effort and maybe a positive message. But once this crisis passes and the recovery and rescue efforts are reaching completion, I think the public in many areas outside of Sichuan is going to turn around and focus more on the daily lives and look at things like inflation, look at housing prices, look at income inequality. So this is a bit of a diversion for the government, but there really are some long-term issues that they have to face after this blows over.
But it will certainly make it much more difficult for the critics to come out hard and heavy, given that China is going to be for some many weeks and months in a very intense mourning period, as we see the numbers of dead has just continues to rise.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that there's more bad news ahead. If you look at the reports, as they access more regions that were cut off from communications and transportation, they're finding some pretty devastated areas. So I think that there's more bad news to come, unfortunately. However, in the weeks to come, I think the government will focus efforts on both in their relief efforts, but also in making sure that they have a plan to follow up with that leading up into the Olympics.
You know, there's enormous investment in China, and I'm wondering if, in some sense, this is a signal to the investment community that China has the infrastructure to deal with a problem like this and to move right back into its full-growth economy.
Well, this is perhaps one of the most difficult areas of the country to reach. So this would be a test for, I think, any rescue apparatus in China and in Europe and the U.S., wherever. So I think long-term investors looking at the China market, I think this kind of event is something that they'd have to look at in areas that are prone to earthquakes. But I think overall the long-term impact on investor sentiment, I think, will be limited. As they dig out in Sichuan, people look around the rest of the economy, Still, China accounts for only 4% of China's economy. There's a lot of dynamism still continuing, and I think that that's going to buoy investor sentiment in the long term.
All right, that's interesting. William has 4% of the economy in Sichuan. That's interesting to learn. China analyst with the forecasting company Global Insight. Thanks for joining us, William.
Thank you. And right now we have on the line Dan Griffiths, the BBC correspondent who's currently in China. And Dan, can you tell us a little bit about where you are? And we've also seen reports this morning that the death toll has now risen to 15,000.
That's right, yes. And today I've been at a middle school in a small town called Juyuan, not that far from the epicenter of the earthquake. The school is...
Oh, I think we may have just lost Dan. I guess that's not terribly surprising.
Yeah.
They were talking about 2,300 towers went down, making it so difficult. And as William was just telling us, that rescue workers are just now getting to areas, very remote areas, that have completely been blocked off.
And I guess that is a reminder, and William was referring to that a moment ago, and we should say that we made like 6 attempts to get Dan Griffiths on the line, which gives you an indication of the infrastructure for communication out there. But the remoteness of these areas of the earthquake is an indication that the main economy of China missed a very serious direct hit. The areas of most devastation are in areas that are not sort of central to the Chinese economy, and they do have the capacity to recover here, as tragic as this is.
But it's such an enormous swath of people that were vulnerable to this earthquake. I mean, somewhere in the tens of millions of people were potentially affected by it.
You know, people forget, you know, China has 1 billion people, and that means in the one province of Sichuan, 87 million people live. I mean, some of the places aren't so densely populated, but 87 million. California only has 36 million. So that just gives you an idea. And Sichuan is about the size of Texas, a little bigger than Texas.
Which is just extraordinary to think. They were saying reports, as we've talked to many people this morning, about bad weather, about rain and low-hanging clouds that made it very difficult for helicopters to get or even drop medicine and food. But I just see there's a report saying that perhaps some of those drops have begun again.
Well, if you go to a map and look at the place where China butts up against the Tibetan Plateau there, and then look at the history of China, the Chinese have had difficulty going up those mountains for thousands and thousands of years. Much of the history of China is the difficulty of getting beyond the Tibetan Plateau and, of course, the protection that those highlands afford people who might be in conflict. In this particular case, it's conflict with the earth itself. More details on China when we come back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I want to bring you up to date on some sports news. Last night, Detroit held off the Orlando Magic and has made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. That was a 91-86 point win. And, you know, it's been a long road back for the NBA since the retirement of Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, who made the NBA, you know, one of the most popular sports in the world, the NBA has had trouble. Basketball has had trouble in the United States since. But the playoffs this year may just turn that around. There are some exciting contests. Detroit-Orlando. Detroit will face the winner of the Celtics-Cavaliers series, which is happening right now. And, of course, the Celtics themselves are an extraordinary comeback from being one of the worst teams in the league. They are now the best team in the league. What is responsible for the comeback of the NBA? And if there's one thing responsible to explain the comeback of the Celtics this year, what is that? Stephen Dubner is still with us. Stephen, is there something behind the scenes besides just great players there at the Celtics, better TV cameras?
The short answer is yeah, in that the Celtics have turned to statistical analysis to try to make themselves better, the way that a lot of baseball teams do.
Right.
Also.
Baseball is all about stats.
But the thing is baseball is a great sport for stats because the events are discrete and it's basically a static game. Basketball is the opposite. The thing is, though, don't forget, the Boston Celtics got two guys, Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen, this year. And in addition to Paul Pierce then, they turned it around to have the best single season best turnaround in league history. So you can't deny that the players are doing it. On the other hand, the Celtics are the team that are probably the most data reliant of any team in the
NBA.
But
how do you measure that in basketball? Because just as you said, first of all, it's such a team sport, and you're talking about a game that moves very, very quickly.
Right.
How do you measure that?
Well, look, there's always been statistics in basketball. So we always know, you know, what percentage a guy
shooting
shoots, three point versus 2 point, and so on. There are many, many, many finer points to get to. So, for instance, if I can watch every possession that LeBron James has ever had from the top of the key when he has the ball and see what the proclivities are when, A, he's double-teamed or when he's not, B, when they collapse into the paint and when they don't, C, whether he goes left, whether he goes right, whether he dribbles, whether he shoots, and so on. Once I know that, and I can, and if I'm the stat guy from the Celtics, and I can successfully feed that information to my coach and get the coach to implement the strategy, then
so
you
the
might gain a very small
edge. Listen.
Yeah,
get
but
it's politics, listen. Is
but,
what it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you say that, though, because you have a quote in your article saying that Coach Doc Rivers, the general manager, says is skeptically receptive to Mr. Zarin's statistical data
Zarin.
Insights.
He's the stat
right.
guy.
Mike Zarin is the stat guy. Right. I would say, what did I say? Skeptically.
You said skeptically receptive.
Yes, yeah, skeptically receptive is about as good as you're going to hope for from a sport coach to listen to a numbers guy.
Well, quickly, how does it work? I mean, do you check out the percentage of shutting down a LeBron James if you double team him? And if it's a low percentage, you say, you know, that doesn't work. We're going to have to shift and do something
you
else.
You do a lot of that. But as I said, it's really hard to get players to respond on the fly via information that you're feeding to your coach. The other big, big piece, this is personnel. In other words, when they trade for Kevin Garnett, they have to look at the guys they're giving up for him and try to project out their productivity for the next 5 years.
Right.
Productivity versus cost.
Right.
Is it a good move?
Right.
They decided yes.
Turnovers are a bigger deal in this analysis. Okay.
Stephen, our shot clock, you know, comes to a close here. Thank you for joining us. As always, Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner. His blog is online. You can see it at the takeaway.org.
Isn't that just about reading tea leaves, though, essentially?
Statistics. It's science.
Yeah, but it's what you're choosing to measure.
That's right. That's true. It's tea leaves. The science of tea leaves.
The science.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have some more headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Femi?
At 12 minutes to the hour, the Labor Department this hour has just released the Consumer Price Index for April. Consumer prices edged up 0.2% last month. Now, after her big win in West Virginia, Hillary Clinton is hoping to slow the tide of superdelegates flowing toward frontrunner Barack Obama. Senator Clinton will be back in Washington, D.C. today, and Senator Obama is campaigning in Michigan. Picture Oklahoma may be history. The government is not going to provide any money for rebuilding homes demolished by a tornado last weekend. People will get relocation help, but the town was already on the chopping block because of mining pollution. In your sports headlines, Barry Bonds faces more felony charges. In a new indictment, the Major League Home Run King is charged with 15 felony counts of lying to a grand jury and hampering the federal government's doping investigation. Bonds' lead attorney says his client is innocent. And finally, for my file from the news of the weird.
It's lost in space.
It is. The British Defence Ministry has opened up previously secret
right.
files
yes.
on sightings of unidentified flying objects, or UFOs. Now, listing some 11,000 sightings since the 1950s. And in one case, a man was out fishing. He reported that he was taken on board an alien ship, but they sent him back because he was too old.
But you have to check this out online. There are these amazing drawings, some of them made by children, and they were classified
11,000 sightings?
11,000
strikes me as low. What are they suppressing? What are they keeping from us? Femi, thank you very much. I love hearing that theme, Lost in Space. I used to watch that show when I was little, before you guys were born, I'm sure.
Also the reruns.
Yeah. We're going to change focus here for a second. Journalists around the world, and we've been talking to some very brave ones in the wake of the Chinese earthquake, but being a journalist in Iraq is certainly not easy. And if you're talking about Western journalists who report from inside the green zone, there's plenty of risk there. You risk being shot or blown up every day. And you don't go anywhere if you're a Western journalist without an armed guard. But being an Iraqi journalist is different. You don't have armed guards, and you have to work in the communities where you live. And so we thought this was a great opportunity to talk about the experience of Iraqi journalists with a man who studies here in the United States and last night received a Foreign Press Association Scholarship Award. Marwan Hamad Saeed is an Iraqi journalist studying at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He undertook a survey of Iraqi journalists. Marwan, it's so great that you came in here to join us. Why do journalists in Baghdad report? Why do they take these risks?
Well, actually, I think that's a hard question to answer soon after the fall of Saddam regime, because the media was under the tight control of the regime, and only in very small numbers of people could become a journalist during Saddam regime, and they had to be loyal to the regime. So many people, to many of us, journalism was a very new idea and very exciting one to enter. And everyone, I'm sure, who became a journalist, they had this idea to become, you know, telling what's going on, you know, telling the people, like conveying the truth. But soon, actually, it was not what we thought it's going to be.
It was a brutal, dangerous business, Adara.
John just mentioned how difficult it is for American journalists or any journalist, but it's particularly difficult for Iraqi journalists covering what's happening there. I understand that you've lost at least five students from the project to violence in Iraq, and one of them was assassinated because she was a journalist.
Yes.
How does that feel, training people who themselves are likely or could become targets?
Well, as I say, in Iraq is a very troubled situation. You know, the numbers are actually scary that getting there. Since 2005, more than 200 journalists and media workers have been killed. So that,
and yet there are hundreds of newspapers in Iraq.
Yes, hundreds, and actually I can say thousands of newspapers and media are running in Iraq. It's just a risk you have to take, and particularly talking about this late journalist Sahar Al-Haidari, which was one of our students and journalists working for us. She was working in Mosul, and actually before she been killed, she survived another kidnapping attempt, and she was injured. And before she was assassinated, she got 13 death threats, and she never actually left her profession until, unfortunately, she was
a heartbreaking
killed.
Story.
What made her keep going? When she would tell you about these threats that were made against her life, what specifically inspired her, despite those threats, to keep reporting?
It's just to believe what you're doing. All of them have belief. She definitely had belief, like she was doing the right thing. Almost all our reporters do that. Just a few days ago, one of our reporters who is supposed to file a story, and he was late from the deadline we set him. So I sent him emails. Actually, he didn't answer, so I called him. And the response I got from him, he said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't get to an internet cafe because he went to do some interview, and on his way a car exploded." So he said he hardly survived. Mm-hmm. And actually he never, it has become so a daily routine, some of them do not tell us even.
Before we go, give us a sense. I mean, all the journalists aren't necessarily trying to get the latest scoop on Muqtada al-Sadr or the military or the insurgency. There are journalists who are working under this same risk who are just reporting the neighborhood stories, what schools are open, how to get from here to there, the price of produce, right?
Oh, definitely. Actually, there is no, especially for the Iraqi newspaper, no hardcore stories. There is no investigative story, nothing. It's just basic stories.
Just basic stories. Marwan Hamid Saeed, thank you. Marwan Hamid Saeed is an Iraqi journalist studying here in the United States. He just won a Foreign Press Association Scholarship Award for conveying the experience of Iraqi journalists in Baghdad and around the country. Adora?
It's a fascinating story. We're going to move back to presidential politics with West Virginia out of the way. There are only five primaries left.
next Tuesday, Kentucky and Oregon. Rick Howlett is the news director with KFPL in Louisville. Rick, we hear Bill Clinton is scheduled to begin stumping hard there on Thursday. And the makeup of Kentucky, does it look a lot like West Virginia or like some other state?
Well, we have, first of all, if I could just slightly correct you, it was WFPL. We're east of the Mississippi, so get that out of the way.
You know, I thought that was right, WFPL. Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, we have 51 pledged delegates here in Kentucky and 9 superdelegates. Senator Clinton has the superdelegate lead 3-2. Both of Kentucky's Democratic congressmen have endorsed Senator Obama. And she is expected to carry the state next Tuesday, May 20th. Senator Obama has said so, pretty much acknowledged that himself, but he has been campaigning here. He was here Monday night and during his rally did not mention the words Senator Clinton once. He lit into Senator McCain, so he's campaigning here like someone who's already won the nomination.
She consistently has been way ahead in the polls there in Kentucky. I think the latest one I'm seeing is somewhere around 27 percentage points. What do you attribute that to?
You know, that's a good question. The African-American population in Kentucky is very small. It's less than 10%, so that's part of it. Obama will do well here in Louisville, which has a larger African-American population. So I think that's pretty much the gist of it. And also, she has been campaigning heavily here over the past couple of months. She has been, we're right on the border with southern Indiana. So of course, she and her husband and daughter made over 100 campaign visits to Indiana. So they got a lot of coverage in Kentucky from that. So that's part of it, too.
Well, Rick, you know, it's interesting because the campaign begins now. I mean, in some ways, everything that's happened up to this point is almost irrelevant to how it's going to proceed because the issues have shifted with the lopsided result in West Virginia.
That is true. She has been talking quite a bit about coal here in Kentucky, as you might imagine. We're a large coal state, and he has talked about it somewhat as well. He has actually co-sponsored some legislation to build a coal-to-liquid fuels plant in Kentucky. So that's been a big issue here, and of course the big issues, jobs and the economy and so forth.
So, Rick, do you think it's a question of Kentucky voters just not knowing a lot of Barack Obama, knowing that much about Barack Obama? You said he spent some time there, but not nearly the kind of time nor had the same kind of coverage that the Clintons have.
I think that's, quite a bit of it. He made two appearances here last year, and he made his first appearance of 2008 in Kentucky just the night before last. So I think, that has quite a bit to do with it as well.
Well Rick, we're going to let you go. Rick Howlett of WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, covering the Kentucky primary, which along with Oregon is next Tuesday. Lots more to come. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
51 delegates there in Kentucky.
It's WFPL,
not KPFL. I said WFPL.
Okay.
All right. Well, we are going to leave you with this thought, okay? There's a big anniversary, and we're going to be marking it tomorrow at thetakeaway.org. The cubicle is turning 40. We're asking for your cubicle photos. How does your cubicle look? Do you think the cubicle is a sign of advancement of civilization or
a step backwards? We want you to send the photos to mytakeatthetakeaway.org along with your name and a description of it, and we'll post it on our website.
No Abu Ghraib pictures, please. Keep your comments coming. We read everything. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.